Welcome to the Science Podcast for August 30th, 2013. I'm Linda Poon.
And I'm Christy Hamilton. This week, the social learning of bird migration, stretchable and transparent ionic conductors, and fecal transplants.
The trial was stopped after 43 patients were treated because the effect was so huge and the difference was so enormous.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
It's that time of the year again when birds fly south for the winter. And unlike us, birds can cover thousands of miles without the guidance of maps or GPS. Instead, birds depend on innate navigation systems and social learning, though how big of a role each factor plays remains a mystery. A new study on the migration of whooping cranes, first taught to migrate by people inside ultralight aircrafts, may finally change that. Researcher Thomas Mueller discusses how 8 years of data on these birds may finally untangle the contribution of genetics and social learning to bird migration.
Successful bird migration can depend on many factors, among them individual learning, social learning, and innate navigation programs. In this study, we were using 8 years of data on migrating whooping cranes and were able to partition genetic and socially learned aspects of migration. We analyzed data from a reintroduced population when all birds were captive bred and artificially trained by ultralight aircraft on their first lifetime migration. Only this first migration is human-assisted. From then on, the birds travel on their own, usually in the company of other whooping cranes. Mm-hmm. Analysis of migration data from these subsequent unaided migration events show that migratory performance improves over many years and that social learning from older birds plays an important role.
So why has it been so challenging in the past to determine how big of a role genetics play compared to how big of a role social learning plays in bird migration?
I think a key problem is that migration generally happens over very broad spatial scales, hundreds and thousands of kilometers. In addition, birds can be long-lived and change their migratory behavior over many years. And these scales make experimental approaches fundamentally difficult. Mm-hmm. Usually, scientists have to rely on observational data from the field, which makes disentangling the learning and genetics aspect difficult.
Mm-hmm. So you were able to do that. You were able to separate genetics from, you know, social learning. And you did this by looking at the eastern migratory population of whooping cranes. So what about the set of data allowed you to separate the two aspects?
There are two key aspects that made these analyses possible. The first is that all birds in this population were captive bred. And that means the pairwise genetic relatedness between the individuals is known. And secondly, the juvenile individuals are all trained on the first southbound migration by ultralight aircraft. So all birds have the same initial learning experience. And from then on, there's an intense monitoring program that allows us to track the changes of the migration events over time as individuals age.
Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at this data, what kinds of information or predictor variables are you focusing on?
The key predictor variables we used here were the age of an individual, so we could basically track how migration changes as individuals age.
Mm-hmm.
And we hypothesized that as a measure of experimental learning. Then we knew the age of the oldest individual in a migration group of cranes, which we hypothesized as an upper limit of experimental learning within each group. And then group size and genetic relatedness were other important factors. With genetic relatedness, we knew how related one individual in the flying group is to another one. So we can figure out if individuals that are more closely related do better or worse in terms of their migratory performance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the result of this study, in general terms, basically says that the presence of older, more experienced birds within the migrating group decreases the deviation from the flight path. So can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, we use deviations from a straight line path between the summer and winter ranges on a migratory route as a proxy for migratory performance. Basically, with the idea, the more direct you migrate from summer to wintering areas, the more efficient the migration is.
Mm-hmm.
And we then examined how much of those deviation at each observed location of a bird could be explained by individual age of the oldest bird in a group and genetic relatedness.
Mm-hmm. So how much improvements did you see in groups with the older, more experienced bird compared to groups with, you know, just younger birds flying together?
We saw about 38% improvement with 7 years of age. That means a migratory group where the oldest bird had an age of one deviated about 75 kilometers from the straight line path, where migratory groups where the oldest individual was 8 years old deviated only about 45 kilometers from the straight line path. The interesting finding here really is that it, A, depends not on the individual age necessarily, but on the age of the oldest bird in a group, and that the improvement happens over many years. And it's not just a difference whether you have done this migration once before, but that really up to 7 years of age, we see an improvement on the migratory performance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's new compared to other studies where often we just know whether a bird is juvenile or adult.
So for a study like this, there are, you know, several other factors that may have affected how successful these bird migration were. This includes the sex of the birds, the seasons, wind drift. So how were you guys able to account for those?
Basically, we built a hierarchical regression models where we incorporate a lot of other factors that may influence migration than just the individual age or the age of the oldest bird in a group. And these would include, for example, sex and season, the particular year a bird was flying in. What we did find is in these deviations from straight line path that they mostly occurred to the east of the straight line path. And so wind drift may play an important role. But again, I think it's the older birds that may mitigate that and may decide that then at a certain time, you just don't fly if the wind is too strong.
Mm-hmm. Now, the data that you looked at were on a very specific group of bird. You know, these were whooping cranes that were all captive bred and they were all artificially trained. So how does your study contribute to the larger picture of conservation and reintroduction of bird species?
I think one important lesson is that if a population or species get extinct, that we not only lose the individuals, but we also lose a culture. And these cultural aspects of behavior need to be relearned, and that can take many years. What that means for reintroduction programs is that I think we need to have patience, and we need to allow for time that animals can relearn behaviors that have been lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, Thomas Mueller, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was nice talking to you.
Thomas Mueller and colleagues report on what underlies migration navigation in this week's issue.
When one visualizes a good conductor, usually metals like copper cables come to mind. But meshing metals with the materials of the human body has not proven very successful. In a paper this week, Zigong Su and colleagues used soft ionic hydrogels as a way to move charge around. The biocompatibility of these next-generation conductors broadens the scope of their use, potentially enabling biomedical devices to converge with human tissues like never before. Sewell talks about the composition of these jelly-like substances and the possibilities they hold for the future.
In this paper, we use stretchable, transparent ionic conductors to make a class of devices. These devices are highly deformable and fully transparent. And most surprisingly, they can operate at frequencies beyond 10 kilohertz and under voltage above 10 kilovolts.
Okay, so can you describe the basic design of these stretchable, transparent ionic conductors?
Yep. You should first think about water. You can add some salt into water. The salt dissolves into ions, and ions are mobile in water. So salty water itself is transparent, and now you also know it's an ionic conductor. But salty water is a liquid. For our device, we want a solid conductor. So this is what we do. We make a hydrogel by combining water with a polymer network. So water enables ionic conduction, and the polymer network provides the solid form. Our hydrogel is more or less like a jello, but is a lot more stretchable. Our work really is a demonstration how to use stretchable and transparent ionic conductors to enable unusual devices.
So how do these ionic conductors differ from other electronic or transparent conductors?
So we have two parallel worlds, electronic devices and human bodies. Electronic devices are mostly made of hard materials, and human bodies, as you know, mostly made of soft materials. To enable electronics to meet skin, heart, and brain, you need stretchable conductors. So a conductor capable of carrying electricity, and it's also stretchable, so hard can meet soft. Stretchable conductors are also needed in biomedical applications, such as soft robots. If you want to make robots kind of like a human being or kind of like a worm, you also need to have nerves kind of like human nerves, stretchable. And so if you think about it, stretchable conductors are all kind of like artificial nerves. It serves the same function. Oh, by the way, the real nerves are made of ionic conductors. So existing stretchable conductors are mostly made of metals. These materials, as you know, are not stretchable, and they are not transparent. They can never match water in terms of transparency. In many applications, attributes other than conductivity and stretchability are also important. For example, you may want to have biocompatibility if you want to implant your device into human body, and also you want transparency. So a human body actually conducts electricity by ions. If you form a thought in your brain and your toe move, that's very fast, but that's all ionic. There's no electronics involved. So it's rather odd that when we develop interface from electronics and human body, we take metal rather than taking what's already inside body, which is gel.
So kind of a biomimetic inspiration.
Essentially, yes,
yeah,
it is.
And can you describe some of your tests to demonstrate the properties of these conductors?
So from the technical measurement, we actually show if you want to have certain high transparency or certain high stretchability, ionic conductors beat all electronic conductors. So by now you probably appreciate our basic discovery is not really about ionic conductors themselves, because after all we use hydrogels. But our discovery is really about how to use ionic conductors to enable high frequency, high voltage devices. The conductors themselves have high resistivity than many electronic conductors. You cannot use water to match copper in terms of conductivity. But as we said, a human body uses ionic conductor for all these years. If ionic conductors are good enough for human bodies, it's probably good for something else as well.
And can you discuss some of your tests, such as the transparent loudspeaker?
Transparent. So we actually have several movies to show that. So one movie shows a actuator. Essentially, is you apply a electrical signal, and this thing moves. We actually use a transparent heart to show heartbeat. This demonstration just shows that you can apply a voltage and make something transparent to deform by a large amount. Then we also try to show this thing can work at high frequency. The frequency is so high we cannot see the motion. So we use a loudspeaker to demonstrate this transparent loudspeaker can produce music.
And so they can operate at high speed and under high voltage, but can they also work for applications that require low voltage or low frequency?
That's a good question. Yes. So we went all the way to do these high frequency. We actually had one more section. to show ionic conductor can work at low frequency or low voltage. For example, they can be used as sensors, meaning you push and then your push is translated into voltage, then electronics can do some processing.
So these hydrogels seem to have a lot of promising applications. What's the next step?
The opportunity is unlimited for device designers. So if you already have a working device that uses electronic conductors, think about it. What if you replace it with ionic conductors? Will it still work? You may sacrifice some performance. For example, you have a low conductivity because ionic conductors have low conductivities, but you gain new attributes such as transparency and stretchability and biocompatibility. So maybe you create a whole new class of devices just by this change of perspective. People's perception has always been, if you use ionic conductors, the device will be very slow. But they keep forgetting, we speak, we hear music, and we see light. These are ionic. This is an exciting time.
Well, Zigong Su, thanks for talking with
me. Thank you.
Zigong Su reports on stretchable ionic conductors in this week's Science.
It seems like there is nothing our gut microbes can't do. This incredibly useful population of bacteria takes up its place shortly after birth, and as far as we know, changes little in composition through our lifetime. The ecosystem inside of us serves to help us digest and fight off disease. But can it help others fight disease as well? Sarah Crespi discussed the feasibility and effectiveness of fecal transplant with Jaap de Vriese. De Vriese starts with a quick description of how one goes about transplanting feces and why.
Usually the patient is already receiving antibiotics. You stop that like 1 or 2 days before the treatment. And then the person gets a bowel lavage. There's some sort of water used to get as much as possible out of the bowel. And the donor comes in and gives his stool, and it's been used through a tube. It can be done through a nasal tube, which ends up at the distal part of the first part of the small intestine. And there's also the colonoscopy, which is used from the other side. And there's also enemas, sort of a balloon, which you use. You can use it at home as well.
Okay. Do they actually, like, purify things in any way when they do this?
They use some water with salt, like saline, and they use it in a blender to sort of mix it, and so that it can be used and it's not too thick. But it's not sort of... there's some small filtering going on as well, and there's also nowadays some attempts to sort of standardize it and make sort of to freeze it and later use it in a later instance.
So fecal transplants have actually been around for a long time. How did this ever come into anyone's head as a way to treat disease?
Well, they have been around very long, the fecal transplants. And there were some reports from China from the 4th century already. And there was this Chinese doctor. He was called Ge Hong. Now, at that time, of course, he didn't know about bacteria, but he might have had some sort of a gut feeling about health, and sort of an unhealthy person or unhealthy animal might be cured by giving him the stool of someone else. And later there's some anecdotal evidence from other periods, like in the 17th century, it was used in cows, and that's still common practice, actually, in treating chickens. Then after the Second World War, there was the uprising of all these infections and also of resistance to antibiotics. And then in 58, there was already the first case of 4 cases were treated by a surgeon called Ben Eisenman, and he treated 4 patients with a sort of infection of their in the guts. And then later, nothing really happened because antibiotics were coming and, well, they were doing well. But then recently, for 10 years, it's been a lot more important to find alternatives to antibiotics. So that's created a revival of this technique.
What kind of disorders might a fecal transplant be useful for?
Well, the thing that's used for the most currently is recurrent infection of a pathogen called Clostridium difficile. And that is a pathogen that usually, it can live in your healthy gut, but it becomes dangerous when you're, for instance, treated with antibiotics and your whole gut flora or the whole ecosystem is sort of disturbed. it takes over and then it creates inflammation. And it's very difficult to treat, and it can be deadly even. It's been proven now that it can be very effective to use fecal transplant to shut down this infection and this Clostridium bacteria. So there's other indications like ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. Those are both inflammatory bowel diseases. That's quite straightforward. But it goes further, and it might even treat autism, depression, metabolic syndrome, and Parkinson's disease, and even acne is being described as being cured by a fecal transplant.
Hmm. So I guess we should take a step back and talk about what a fecal transplant is and how scientists think it might actually work.
Yeah, so it starts with the whole idea that the gut is filled with all these different species of bacteria, in particular the large bowel. And when it's in balance, it's fine, and it interacts with the body, and it's fermenting the food, and then it's fine. But when it's sort of out of balance and can all have different causes, like antibiotics, then things go wrong, and these bacteria might take over, and there are some toxins that end up in the body and can cause all these different problems. And the whole idea of a transplant is that you sort of rebalance it by introducing a new balanced ecosystem with all these different species that are in a healthy gut.
So far, most of the reports on the effectiveness of these transplants as a treatment have been anecdotes, one doctor doing it to several patients, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been some randomized control trials and more in the works. How have those fared so far?
Well, there is one recent trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2013, actually this year. It was done by a group in Amsterdam. They wanted to treat like 150 or around that number of patients with a recurrent Clostridium infection, difficile. So half of them would be treated with this fecal transplant, and the other groups, two other groups, one with vancomycin and the normal treatment, and the other one was vancomycin and a bowel lavage, taking away everything. The trial was stopped after 43 patients were treated because the effect was so huge and the difference was so enormous, like a 90% cure in the treatment group of fecal transplants and like one-third in the other groups. So that was a very strong result. But it was not blinded, so there could be some placebo effects in there, but, well, it's not very important, this placebo effect, because it's such a strong disease.
I was going to say, how would you do a blind fecal transplant
trial? Yeah, that's an interesting one. That's what they also do in other trials that are running with other indications now, that they take the stool from the patient and from the donor, and then the patient receives a stool from the donor or from his own donation. The researcher from Amsterdam was telling me that some people afterwards were saying, oh, I'm sure that was not my own stool because it smells differently. Mm-hmm. But actually, they weren't always right because, well, it just changes.
All right. So in the meantime, while these trials are going on and researchers are trying to sew up the evidence, people are actually trying this at home. There are, you know, do-it-yourself videos online. What kind of dangers might do-it-yourselfers face, and are there any regulations for this?
There haven't been any notions of strong or heavy side effects or even things really go wrong, but there are risks. Well, you might transmit a virus that you don't know of. There might be some parasites or pathogens that are not giving any symptoms to the donor, but they might give problems in the receiver, in the patient, because it's already weak in person. Sort of a short-term effect. And on the long term, there's always correlations with all these diseases like cancer that might be correlated with certain compositions of microbiota in the gut. And when you transplant a composition of a healthy donor that might later develop this, then you could also develop this in the long term. Normally, in a clinical setting, the donor is screened for all these things, but when you do it yourself, it's a difficult thing. For at home, there's no real regulation because, well, it's not really easy to check this. So.
Right. There are actually some groups out there looking to avoid the hazards that you described earlier, maybe getting gut microbiota that work for the healthy person but don't work well in the sick person, or transmitting viruses or other unwanted beasties. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to do this by only introducing specific strains of bacteria.
Yeah.
How might that work? Is it different than probiotics?
Yeah, it's different than probiotics because the usual probiotics that you can buy in the shops, those are lactobacilli, for instance, those are strains that don't really stay in the gut. They can enter and they pass, and then after a couple of days they're gone because they don't colonize the gut. And the strains that you're interested in for these applications, those are anaerobic bacteria that don't want air or oxygen. They stay, and so they're more or less stronger, so to say. That makes it more difficult to culture them in the lab, because then you need all these facilities without oxygen. And a lot of these bacteria have been very difficult to culture. But now, recently, there's some new techniques coming up that make this possible, and there are some initiatives that aim to select sort of a smaller set of strains that are not dangerous, and they might be good for sort of introducing the new balance. There's this Canadian initiative with 33 strains. It's called Repopulate. Very nice name. But it was actually halted in 2011 by the Health Canada, the Canadian FDA, because it's sort of regarded as synthetic, and that's, and then they had to enter the whole drug protocol. There's also another initiative. It's called Rebiotics, and they are now sort of going through a trial to test a larger set of, like, more than 100 strains.
Great. All right. Well, Jaap de Vriese, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Jaap de Vriese is a freelance science writer based in the Netherlands. He writes about the promise of poop this week.
Finally today, Kelly Cervik, an intern for our online daily news site, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories. So, Kelly, first up, we have a story on how much a fetus can hear. I've heard the recommendation that pregnant women should talk to their fetuses, but a new study here looks at how much they're actually hearing.
Right. It's been known for a while that when a baby is in the uterus, they're actually experiencing a lot of what's going on. And that's where a lot of those recommendations came from, that sound processing parts of their brain have already developed and they can hear sort of muffled sounds pretty well through the abdomen. So some studies have already looked at what babies are able to sort of recall from those early experiences. And one even showed that they could remember the theme song from their mother's favorite soap opera.
So what's the timing here? How old are these fetuses?
These fetuses were in their last trimester, so already pretty developed.
So this study uses a new method to test this idea. But before we get to that, can you talk about some of the other methods that have been used before and what they found?
Sure. Those kind of methods relied mostly on babies' behaviors, which, as you would imagine, are kind of unreliable. But they showed in one study that babies were familiar with a sound because they were more likely to suck on this high-tech pacifier to hear more of the sounds that were associated with their native language than one that they would not have heard while they were in the womb.
So they were familiar with a sound and they wanted to encourage it with the pacifier. What do they do differently here?
This was an EEG study, so they were actually looking at the electrical activity in the baby's brains going direct to the source. And what they did was play recordings of this made-up word, ta-ta-ta, many times over during the woman's pregnancy so that these babies had heard this sound approximately 25,000 times. And then when the infants were born and they played that sound, their brains showed that they were recognizing this sound differently from other sounds.
So it was important that it was a nonsense word then?
It was important that it was a nonsense word since it wasn't a part of their native language. So it wasn't really something that they would recognize in English, but not if it were in Swedish.
So what was different between the trained babies and the untrained babies?
Well, the trained babies actually showed this brain response, this recognition. And interestingly, that response was strongest in the infants who had heard the recording most often.
Should this result change anything about the way parents talk to their future babies when they're still in the womb?
Well, the researchers point out that there's not much evidence that there's any long-term benefit for healthy babies in hearing any particular sounds outside of what you'd normally hear in the womb. But what they do suggest is that this could be a treatment for children who are at risk for auditory processing disorders or dyslexia. But pregnant mothers shouldn't be so quick to put the headset up to their pregnant belly, because the researchers also warn that holding speakers too close to the fetus could actually cause damage or overstimulate the ears or disrupt the baby's sleep cycles.
Next up, we have a story on how money relates to cooperation. Money is often tagged as the root of all evil, but as this study seems to show, it can strengthen trust in larger groups.
That's right. So economists have known for a long time that money does something very special in terms of changing the way people negotiate. Having sort of a symbolic token of value instead of just exchanging one good for another good makes really complicated swaps. Like if I wanted to exchange a cow for a year's supply of bread, for example, makes those swaps a lot simpler. And there's one theory that sort of in the evolution of societies, using money allowed people to cooperate and trade when they were in big groups where individuals weren't really able to trust each other, weren't really able to trust that you're going to return that year's supply of bread if I give you my cow right now.
So how do we test this today? How can you look at the relationship between trust and group size and that kind of thing?
So the way that these researchers tried to tackle the question was by inviting a bunch of people to participate in this sort of bargaining and investing game. About 200 people came into a room full of computers and got divided up into groups of different sizes, 2, 4, 8, 32 people. And the people in these groups started out with a set number of units on the computer, and their goal was to maximize their earnings of units. And they actually got to take home real cash at the end based on how many units they had.
How did trust come into play there?
So the idea was that the people in these groups were paired up. And one partner had the choice of whether they wanted to spend 6 of their units to help their partner get 12 units. If you do this, obviously, you're taking a risk that this is not going to pay off later. But if you get that same partner later on and the tables are turned, they're more likely to spend their 6 units to give you 12 units. That's the trust element.
So in the second experimental setup, they introduced this concept of tokens. Those were a stand-in for money?
Exactly, yeah. This was sort of a virtual form of money. And everyone started out with 2 tokens, and you could spend a token, pay your partner a token, so that they would help you out using their units to get you more units.
And so how did that introduction of this metaphorical money affect small groups and large groups and their ability to trust each other?
Well, in smaller groups, using these tokens actually eroded that sense of trust and people's cooperation dropped. But in bigger groups, where people were less likely to trust each other before, now using this symbolic monetary system, they cooperated almost twice as often and everyone ended up with a bigger payoff at the end.
So all the subjects in this study were used to using money. They grew up with it around them. So how generalizable is this result? Can we actually take this and say something about the history of culture and money?
That's a good question. That's what the researchers are trying to do. They're trying to say that maybe when money got introduced, it sort of drove early cultures to have bigger populations that could cooperate. They say that that's something they would like to try and do with more isolated groups like tribes in the Amazon. But obviously, there are some logistical issues and they would have to sort of change this computerized format to make that happen.
So finally, we have a story on funny faces. Our brains get used to seeing the same things day in and day out, and they actually create normalcy for us.
That's right. So it's a pretty well-known strategy in the brain that once you see something over and over, your brain starts to devote less energy to it so that you can focus on new things. And that's really crucial to our ability to perceive and interpret the world around us. And this new study looks at this really bizarre phenomenon called visual adaptation, where if we see a distorted face over and over, it'll make a normal face start to look odd.
This study actually looks at the relationship between this phenomenon you describe, visual adaptation, and memory. Why do they think those two things might be related?
Well, they wanted to find out whether visual adaptation is kind of a prelude to forming memories. So they decided to look at how sleeping, which we know is involved in consolidating our memories, plays a role in visual adaptation.
So they did use some weird faces in this study. Who did they distort?
They chose 2 particular weird faces. These were George Clooney and Angelina Jolie. And they sort of compressed and stretched the faces in various ways, so they looked kind of like funhouse mirror versions of their celebrity selves.
And then people were exposed to those weird versions of their faces for a long time?
That's right. They saw these different stretched out versions over and over. And then some of those people got to go home and go to sleep. And some of them stayed awake for 12 hours and looked at the faces again.
And what was the effect of sleep on their results?
So the people that went to sleep and came back were actually more likely when they looked at normal faces to perceive them as being distorted compared to the people that didn't sleep.
Those are people who went home and went to bed. There could be other things going on there, like time of day, or they saw a lot of weird things on TV. So
that's right. So the team tried to control for that with a second test where people saw the faces and then some of them took a 90-minute nap while their brain activity was recorded with EEG sensors, and the other group did not get to take that nap. And they saw the same effect, that the people who took the nap were more likely to see normal faces and think they were stretched out, and people who had spent more time in REM sleep, this sort of very important memory consolidating phase of sleep, had an even bigger distortion effect.
So it looks like there is some kind of link between sleep and visual adaptation and possibly memory. What's the takeaway here?
Well, the researchers think that this visual adaptation might be sort of an early stage of the memory process. So now they want to look more into how we consolidate memory during sleep, whether we're removing things that we don't need or sort of replaying things over and over, and which of those might be accounting for this weird new normal that we create.
So what else is on the site this week, Kelly?
So we also have stories about global warming, how it might be on a temporary hiatus, and also new findings about what happens in our brain to cause memory loss as we age. And this week on Science Insider, our policy blog, we have several stories, including one about the probable cause behind hundreds of dolphin deaths along the East Coast. And Science Live, the weekly live chat on Thursdays, starts back up for the fall on September 19th. So check back for more on that.
Thanks, Kelly. Kelly Cervic is an intern for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
And that concludes the August 30th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Christy Hamilton.
And I'm Linda Poon. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.